Do the transcripts from Flight 3407 cast a shadow over just regional airlines or our entire system of training pilots? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest today, as is often the case on Mondays, is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, which you can find online. Bob also operates Bob Miller Flight Training in the Buffalo, New York area, and we often get together on Mondays to talk about safety issues, and we have a discussion that may end up spilling over for 2 days this week, because I want to talk with Bob about the crash of Continental Connections Flight 3407, operated by Colgan Air Division of Pinnacle, that happened just a few miles from where Bob lives. That plane came down in Clarence Center, New York, which is not very far from where Bob lives and where his flight school is located in Lancaster. Bob, thanks for taking some time out today.
Hello, Paul. It's good to be here.
All right. Let's start in, Bob, by talking about some of the things the media has had, the general media especially, has had going on regarding 3407 and where they have kind of maybe misled the public into a false impression of what actually went on here. Is there anything that has come out since the initial media reporting that has surprised you?
Well, I think what surprised us is an affirmation of what the ultimate problem was in that airplane and in that disaster, and it had to do with crew proficiency or the lack thereof. We've ruled out weather pretty much. Icing was a bit of a factor. They've ruled out the fact that mechanical issues were not an issue. I had an opportunity recently to speak with Jim Hall, the former NTSB chairman, who was quite vocal within days after the crash of that airplane to indict the Q400 and literally all turboprop airplanes as being unsafe vehicles to be flying in wintertime icing conditions. When I asked Mr. Hall if he still stood by that observation and indictment, he basically apologized and recanted his statement, saying, no, that was in fact, and I'm quoting him directly, he says, that was a mistake on my part. I spoke too soon, and the evidence is in, and it is not the problem with the turboprop airplanes. The issues of icing and equipment were not the fact. It's coming down to crew issues.
Okay, now, among the other things that were mentioned as being possible factors was a problem with the ILS on the runway at Buffalo. That has been, while they're still apparently not completely satisfied that there's no problem there, that was cleared as having any implication in this accident.
Well, when the shortly after the accident, we were looking, our investigators were looking in all directions as possible explanations. I know the Southwest Airlines Pilot Union came out and said, well, there's a NOTAM out that the glide slope is unusable 5 degrees right of course, and this was totally debunked within 24 hours. That ILS glide slope system has been in operation for years, and there's hundreds of operations, IFR operations coming into Buffalo, and that was totally disproven as a contributing factor.
Bob, do you have any reason to believe that the fact that another Colgan Air flight came in, the same exact equipment, same exact route from Newark, came in, 27 minutes separated from 3407 and had an uneventful landing, had anything to do with how this investigation has gone?
Yes, I think the fact that there were hundreds of landings every day in wintertime conditions, both here in Buffalo and around the United States, in Q400s, in exactly the same conditions, that land uneventful. This was indeed an aberration, something unique, something terribly significant went wrong. And now, after the investigations have been complete, we know it went wrong, and it's something that needs to be talked about. It needs to be addressed, and it's not only at the airline level. What went wrong has its seeds of foundation way back in the primary training level.
All right. One of the things that private pilots starting out are not really trained in to the extent that they are expected to know in the airline business is the issue of a sterile cockpit. I think in reading the transcript of 3407, the thing that popped out at me was that these folks were being very casual and sort of flippant about the tasks at hand, well below the 10,000 feet where the sterile cockpit rule should have been in effect.
That was a clear violation of federal regulation. There was no sterile cockpit in effect in that fleet that night. And from what I'm told and what I understand, this is one of the most flagrantly abused federal air regulation in all airline operations. As you know, the cockpit voice recorder is automatically erased at the end of every flight. There's no provision for management or the FAA to review cockpit voice recordings after every normal flight. Therefore, there's no check and balance. The crew know that these tapes are not going to be reviewed unless, of course, there's a tragic accident, which indeed is very rare. But I think one of the things I hope comes from this is that that rule will change, that these tapes will be retained. They will be subject to FAA audit, management audit, and crew should not object. If they're attending to the flight, they're complying with the federal or with the sterile cockpit rule, there should be no objection. Our recordings with ATC are recorded. Our communications with ATC are recorded. We know that. That doesn't bother anybody.
Well, and for that matter, if you work in an office and you're using company email, there's a clear understanding backed by legal precedent that that any communications while you're on the job using the boss's equipment are subject to his review. I mean,
that's right. That's exactly right, Paul. And it's no secret that the pilots' unions throughout the years have vigorously opposed, back in the beginning, vigorously opposed the use of any kind of cockpit recording device. And they conceded the point once management agreed and the FAA agreed that the tapes would be erased at the end of every normal flight. Then a concession was made by the unions. But this is going to have to change. You know, the rights of two pilots compared to the rights of 50 members of the traveling public in the back, there is no comparison. Pilot rights at this point, and we're pilots. But we have to recognize and accept the fact that operating in this environment, all actions that we take, everything that we say and do is subject to audit, and it should be.
All right, Bob, we're going to take a break, but you had mentioned in passing that there were some shortcomings that you felt went back before the training of these pilots by the airline for which they worked that went back to the earliest days of their flight instruction. And that's an interesting perspective I haven't heard elsewhere. I want to talk about that in a moment. Bob Miller is my guest. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près de moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here along with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, talking about the release last week of the transcript of Flight 3407 that came down on approach to Buffalo Niagara International Airport, and talking specifically about issues which may have put Rebecca Shaw, the first officer, and Marvin Renslow, the captain of that flight, have set them up over a period maybe of years to be in an unfortunate situation. Bob, you have said that in the past that you used to feel that candidates for the airlines that passed through flight training at the primary level had some time to work some things out, that some things might not have been as critical in their preparation because obviously, they're going to go through a very, very tough gauntlet before they ever got into the even the right seat of an airliner that would straighten out any shortcomings accumulated up to that point. You're feeling now like that myth has been shattered.
I do believe that myth has been shattered, Paul. Just from the actions, the training that is played through at Colgan Air and some of the other regionals. The training that takes place there on aircraft systems, how the various systems on the airplane work. What we're seeing now is elements of primary training, stall recovery. This is not included in the airline training program. this is a clear-cut case on this particular flight of an instance where Johnny can't read. We've seen this in the teaching profession. We've seen this in the medical profession, in the legal profession. Every now and again, individuals are sliding through the various checkpoints along the way, and they get to a point in their profession when all of a sudden we discover that there are serious lapses in their ability, in their basic skills. And the only place we can trace this back to is right in through their primary training. And unfortunately, and I've been quite outspoken on this, I know that a number of flight schools have been extremely lax in their preparation of private pilots and instrument pilots. Somehow they give them just what the FAA requires as an absolute minimum. They squeak through the check ride, they get their rating, they squeak through the next check ride, they get their rating. And eventually, as this tragedy proves, they reach a point where they're unable to respond to a simple emergency condition. Worse, they allow the airplane to get into an emergency condition when, had they been attending to what they should have been doing, wouldn't have happened in the first place.
Well, now, for some people, Bob, just observing a sterile cockpit rule would leave them alone with their own thoughts a little more and be less distracting. Is that an issue here, or do you think this goes back to just not knowing how to handle a stall?
Well, two things happen here. The violation of the sterile cockpit resulted in the fact that they are not paying attention. There's been some, one news writer wrote a headline, Complacency to Catastrophe in 15 Seconds. Complacency. This is what was occurring in the cockpit at that particular time. Even the fact that they knew and discussed the presence of ice on the aircraft, there was no apparent attempt to deal with the changing conditions of that aircraft. They were complacent. They were complacent simply because they weren't out watching the airspeed indicator. And it's not just Captain Renslow in this case. The first officer, Ms. Shaw, she had an equal responsibility and a duplicate set of instruments on her side. Neither one of them made any comment, it wasn't picked up on the cockpit voice recorder, that they are dangerously slow in the air. So that was the first problem. The second problem occurred, obviously, when the stick shaker took place. Now, what do we do about this? Rather than pushing forward on the stick, adding power, a 25-pound pull was measured on the yoke. So he did, or they did, exactly the wrong thing. So right there are two things, from complacency to catastrophe in 15 seconds. One, allowing the airplane to slow to such a precipitous airspeed. And two, when the stick shaker fired, they did absolutely the wrong thing. Now, you know, there's no way we can blame Colgan Air on that. We can talk about fatigue. We can talk about crew scheduling. We can talk about poor training practices. But these are so elementary, these two single acts, allowing the airplane to slow and the inability to recover from a stall. It just raises one to a point of anger that this was allowed to take place in a profession that you and I both love. Why this happened, and it happened or originated at the most basic of pilot training levels. And I know I sound like I'm preaching and I'm on a soapbox, but Paul, I've worked with dozens of pilots that have come to me for a flight review, and I've asked them to demonstrate a stall for me, and it is pathetic what I see. They bring the airplane up into a stall, you know, a slight stall, a little bit of a ripple on the wings, the squeaking of the stall horn, and they quickly push the nose forward, and they explain to me that was their stall recovery. This is purely a fault of the instruction. In other words, if the student can't learn, it's because the teacher didn't teach. And I think this should, I hope, Colgan Air, this incident serves to refocus light on what's taking place in flight schools at the primary level.
Well, Bob, we're out of time for today, but tomorrow let's pick this discussion up and let's talk about what could change. We've talked about what went wrong. Let's talk about how to make it right. Bob Miller has been my guest of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, and we'll be back with more of this conversation tomorrow. You can find out more about Over the Airwaves at www.overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.